but it's always time to go exploring. Welcome to Outdoor Pursuits with yours truly, Jade Quinn McDonald. This episode was recorded on the unceded ancestral territory of the Squamish and Lil'wat people, and we are going to be broadcasting through the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coast Salish people's lands. Today, I have a guest, very special, Shelley Quinn, my mom. All right. Well, we are in bed this morning, and we're laying back with a cup of coffee. Don't have to be in studio, which is nice. And today we're going to talk about my mom's role as the general manager of the Whistler Adventure School. All right. Do you want to give a brief introduction to what the Whistler Adventure School is?
Sure. So Whistler Adventure School is an accredited post-secondary school in British Columbia, located here in Whistler. Quite a unique school. It's a non-traditional way of learning, and we focus on outdoor adventure, tourism, and sport. So very unique in that we offer programs to students from Canada and all over the world, really. We're about 50% Canadian and then 50% international. And we do things ranging from taking already very proficient skiers and bikers and getting them qualifications to work in the industry or to go further on with their dreams. So we have a ski and snowboard guide training program that helps students get the skills that they need really to go the next step. Becoming an actual accredited ski guide takes many years of accreditation, but our program kind of fast-tracks students who want to accumulate the skills and knowledge they need to enter into that stream. Right. And bike guide program also takes proficient bikers and gets them the first aid training and PMBI qualifications so that they can actually work in the industry. We get lots of international students wanting to do this. Obviously, there's a lot of street cred that goes along with coming to Whistler and studying and working in the guide industry here so that if they want to go back to their own countries, they have some experience.
Right. Okay, so it sounds like what you need to be a bike guide maybe isn't as demanding as what you might need to be a ski guide in this
day and
age. Yeah,
absolutely. The bike guide, definitely it's based on your own skill and experience and then having a couple of accreditations that you can get pretty easily and then just working up your skill levels. PMBI does have higher levels. So if you're wanting...
What does PMBI stand for?
Oh, it's the Professional Mountain Bike Instructors Association.
Okay.
So, you know, Whistler Adventure School, which we abbreviate down to WAS, we do use secondary trainers if we want our students to get accreditation that is going to be valid outside of the province. So PMBI is pretty much accepted all over North America. And then we also have programs that are designed for other skills in the adventure tourism industry, but where you don't need to already be an expert skier or biker. There's mountain sport technician that is more the background skills. So becoming a certified bike mechanic, learning sustainable trail building from the lead trail builder here in Whistler, Dan Raymond, who is the trail builder for WORCA, which is the Whistler Off-Road Cycling Association.
Mm-hmm.
So amazing skills, learning the importance of building trails that are going to last.
Yeah.
And then also doing boot fitting, ski and snowboard production. So things to make people job ready here in Whistler or anywhere in the Sea to Sky or anywhere if they live in a bike or ski town and want to get those skills.
Right. Okay. You serve it all.
That's great. And then I guess the other two quickly, I don't want to go too long, but marketing and media, which is doing all of the kind of photography, videography, digital marketing. So we do get some kind of semi-professional athletes who want to build their own brand, which is themselves, and they need to have better YouTube and Instagram and, you know, all of that. Or people who do just want to take those skills and work in just about any industry. And then finally, adventure tourism, summer and winter, which really is just getting out into the mountains with certified mountain guides, learning skills, backpacking, multi-day trips, navigating, map planning, all that kind of stuff. So definitely different from the kind of traditional schooling mm-hmm. that, and lots of our students have finished their traditional schooling right. and are looking for a break.
Yeah. So when you say accredited post-secondary institution, is that something that you guys had to fight for? Do you know the history of getting that label?
Well, the school was started a few years before I started, but there's definitely a process, a pretty rigorous process to become an accredited school. And, you know, it's really meant for protection for the student. So it means that all of our curriculums have been vetted by professionals. It's all gone through the government to make sure that we're delivering a quality program right. because, you know, an unaccredited school could pop up overnight
yeah.
and be claiming to be delivering something. And then this gives students that extra layer of protection
mm-hmm.
For their money as well. So that if someone took a course and said, hey, this isn't what you said it was going to be, mm-hmm. they have the backup of
right.
going to the government.
And I remember a few years ago, we went on a trip to the interior where you were talking to a bunch of different universities about maybe filtering students from the Whistler Adventure School who wanted to go to more intense post-secondary, like the SROM program in Selkirk mm-hmm. and different programs like that. How many students actually pursue post-secondary education further in this specific industry from Whistler Adventure School?
Well, the public post-secondary, which would be degree granting, mm-hmm. and that's kind of the difference between a private and a public, the main ones here in BC would be College of the Rockies, mm-hmm. Selkirk, and Capilano.
Right.
And I would say every year, you know, it's maybe we take up to 100 students a year, and it's a pretty small percentage mm-hmm. that decide. But I mean, I can think of definitely a handful of students who have gone on. Either also Thompson River
mm-hmm.
have an outdoor program, so we've had a couple of students go on to Thompson River. We've had students go on to, I know that there's a couple right now studying in Victoria. Mm-hmm. So definitely, especially for the international students, we are a good kind of segue into studying in Canada, getting their English level up to what they mm-hmm. need, and then carrying on.
Right.
Also, inversely, we get some students who were studying in traditional post-secondary and found that it wasn't really delivering what they were looking for. So they decided they didn't want to maybe just study theory mm-hmm. about photography. They wanted to learn how to take pictures. Mm-hmm. And that's a big difference between a hands-on school and a more traditional school. So not dissing, you know, universities, no. obviously there's, you know, that's a completely different set of qualifications. Mm-hmm. But some students will maybe decide even after their degree that they want to just do something to round things out if they do have the desire to work in the adventure tourism industry.
Totally. Cool. And you said a lot of your students are international. Is that mainly because of the kind of more soft English requirement that WAAS has?
No, I mean, it's the setup of WAAS being a private post-secondary, and that was always the intent, was mm-hmm. to make it kind of a international. I always, when I look at the demographics of our school being about 50% from Canada, and then, you know, the rest of the students being from really all over the world, it kind of is like the population in Whistler
mm-hmm.
when you look at it. You know, Whistler is made up of people who have a desire to live in the outdoors and live their best quality of life. And so we really just attract students who are looking for that. And some of them do decide they want to keep on living in Whistler because, you know, it's a pretty special community, as you know, because mm-hmm. you grew up here.
Oh, I did. Okay, so how do you wrangle students from all over the world? How do they find out about Whistler Adventure School?
Well, that's a process. Definitely, it's gone through a few iterations since I've been with the school for about 7 years. And we do it a variety of ways. We work with kind of high school counselors here in Canada. So we make sure that the high school counselors. You know, I do trips to the interior, to the island, just to make sure that the counselors in high schools in BC know that we exist as an alternative for students when they're deciding what they want to do. Because again, going straight into a more traditional university isn't always the answer for every mm-hmm. student. And they might want to learn hard skills to maybe start their own business or just to get, you know, get a better idea of what they want to do. And then internationally, obviously social media is big, and we mm-hmm. have an amazing, amazing person who does all of our social media. So we do lots of videos and photos and share on our social media platforms. And then we go directly to different countries, particularly in areas where there's a high concentration of people who practice either biking mm-hmm. or skiing mm-hmm. or climbing, just to let people know that we exist. Because I think that's our biggest challenge being a small school, is getting the name out there.
Mm-hmm.
But when we go into certain areas, you know, obviously bikers pretty much worldwide, if they watch YouTube videos or whatever, they've heard of Whistler, because Whistler has Crankworks. Most of the pro bikers come here at some point and post videos. So it's definitely helpful to go to those areas and let people know that this exists, that mm-hmm. there's a way. And those students get to come in to Canada. They apply for a study permit with work allowance, the idea being that they can support themselves here in Whistler and work in the area that they're studying. So, you know, if they're working in mountain sport technician, they're going to get experience working as a bike mechanic, a ski tuner, a boot fitter, and getting experience here is obviously really welcoming if they go back to their own country. So if, you know, if they live in Queenstown, New Zealand, and they've done all of these skills here, it gives them work experience and skills to take back to their own country.
Incredible. All right. So do you sales trips?
I do.
Oh,
what a surprise. And as it happens, it is something I really enjoy doing. And mm-hmm. I'm very fortunate with the school that, you know, I can kind of come up with the main ideas to do the sales trips. And yeah, get to go to all kinds of amazing places. 2023 was definitely a busy year, I think, especially after those couple of pandemic years where we didn't travel,
mm-hmm.
Kind of made up for lost time. And we went, do you want me to tell you where we went in 2023? Or?
Might as well just run through them pretty quick.
Yeah. Well, I guess end of 2022, we went to Mexico. And then early 2023, did a trip to Chile and Argentina,
mm-hmm.
Which was amazing, going to mainly biking and or skiing destinations. And South America's great for that, because mm-hmm. you know, that Chile and Argentina both have mountains, so they definitely have lots of people interested. And then in September, October, we went to Scotland, where there's lots of bikers and skiers, and also France, Switzerland, and Italy, which was amazing. And then back to Mexico, just got back a week ago, actually.
Oh, I thought you were looking a bit tan. So sounds like you've been back to Mexico twice now, representing the Whistler Adventure School. Is that right?
Actually, more like three times.
More like three times.
And it's kind of changing in its focus, and we're realizing different ways to both spread the word about Whistler and the Adventure School and kind of give back a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to delve into that part a little bit more?
So mountain biking in Mexico is becoming really popular. I wouldn't say mainstream, but, you know, in a country, you know, Mexico City alone has more people than Canada.
Mm.
So there are a lot of people, and there are actually a lot of mountains in Mexico. People kind of aren't aware. It is warmer, so there's not skiing, but there's amazing mountains and volcanoes and terrain. So people have definitely started mountain biking, and there's a few mountain bike destinations or areas that mainly are Mexican people doing them.
What are some of those ones?
So near Mexico City, mm-hmm. there's Ajusco and Desierto de los Leones. Excuse my pronunciation. Those are both kind of parks that have opened up and are starting to embrace mountain biking.
Right.
Not quite in the same way as Whistler with lift access, mm-hmm. but they do shuttle access.
They're still doing that on the Sunshine Coast.
Yeah, that's true. There's lots of places in the world where, you know, if they don't have lifts for skiing, it's less likely they're going to build lifts. But they've found amazing ways. You know, it was the same in Italy. In Finale, they use trucks and shuttles mm-hmm. to get you to the top. And then they've got amazing tracks coming down. They hold big enduro races. When we were in Mexico City last year, they had a huge enduro race with probably close to 500 people. So, you know, it's a big deal in Mexico. And what we realized in talking with some of our connections down there, some past students, I have one guy who took some courses with us, and he owns a bike shop mm-hmm. in a town called Cholula outside of Puebla. And he was like, oh, Shelley, it would be great if we could get someone to help us with trail building here in Mexico. And so really that kind of twigged us to realize, like, yeah, that would be an amazing thing to take one of our instructors to Mexico and offer some kind of clinics for locals in areas. So with the help of this guy, Sam, from Cholula, he set us up with a few of his contacts in different areas in Mexico to bring our trail builder down and do trail building, sustainable trail building clinics, really focused on helping them to get some local people that would be able to better design and build the trails so that they're going to last, so right. that first big rainfall doesn't just wash the trails mm-hmm. away. So there's a lot of focus put on water management mm-hmm. and making sure that when they're building the trails, those trails are still going to be around, you know, in 5 years, 10 years, and they're not having to rebuild them. And this was, it was super successful. We mm-hmm. had a trail builder who's actually on Vancouver Island now, Dakota, and he came down and we did trail building clinics in 5 different places in Mexico.
Oh, fantastic. So when we're talking about sustainable trail building, is this in places where they want, like, tourists to come? Is it places where locals are attracted to, in parks? And
yeah, it's a bit of both. It does tend to be more for the locals mm-hmm. there. But, you know, it might be locals from that area, but if the trails become a little bit more populated, then, you know, people will make the trip from Mexico City up to Hidalgo, like mm-hmm. to Mineral del Chico, which is one area. And it was also, I think, helpful for some of these areas to work with the authorities. They invited the people because for them to see that, oh, mountain biking is a growing sport and it can be done sustainably. It doesn't have to be in conflict with nature. Mm-hmm. Having someone show that, no, we're not going to cut down a bunch of trees. We're going to work around the trees. We're going to use the existing terrain, use the rocks to build things up, but it's still friendly for bikers, for hikers, and for wildlife. So mm-hmm. I think it was helpful, I know, in a couple of those areas to have the people, because it is a newer sport, mm-hmm. the people in the parks might think like, oh, these bikers, they're going to come and wreck everything. And just to have someone from a destination and realize that it can be a good economic developer
yeah.
and good for people just to get outdoors mm-hmm. and enjoy the outdoors in a way that it is still friendly. They're not driving the trucks up the trails. There's mm-hmm. already access roads in these places, kind of, you know, here in BC, they're logging roads mainly that we use. And it's the same idea in Mexico. So they're not looking at cutting down trees to build trails. They're looking at using existing forest land and parkland to just make these trails even more sustainable so that people aren't just biking willy-nilly down mm-hmm. in the forest. They've got a cool trail with a berm and mm-hmm. built features that work with the terrain.
That's fantastic. So did you guys do much riding when you were in Europe?
A little bit. I mean, I'm there to work, of course. But the nice thing is...
Gotta see the product.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing is that I work for a school that teaches stuff I love doing. And I mean, for me, the biggest challenge is I am not a double black diamond huck cliff kind of rider, but... You know, I did. I've lived in Whistler a long time, so I enjoy mountain biking. On the last trip in Europe, we biked in Scotland in a few places, which was really cool. I feel very fortunate. I get to meet kind of really key industry players, and really, what we're offering. We were working with an organization in Scotland called Developing Mountain Biking in Scotland, and. You know, we work with them to let them know the opportunities here in British Columbia. I think Whistler and even BC are known as kind of really being leaders in the mountain biking industry. And there's a big symposium every 2 years called Mountain Biking in British Columbia. And, you know, I let these different areas. So we've invited the guys from Scotland. You guys should come, maybe take our trail building course. They could take key people from their organization to just take some lessons. And it's not so much like we do it best, but really Whistler has been doing it the longest. And we have attracted some pretty key people in the industry. So being able to train people from other areas that they can then go back to their area and say, here are some takeaways that we have from being in Whistler. Here's the way they do some of the trails. Our way might not work for everywhere, and that's certainly not what we're trying to teach, but it's just giving those skills that are transferable to take back.
Totally. So compared to the scene in Mexico and Latin America, is Europe eons ahead, or are they kind of just on a different track?
Yeah, surprisingly. I mean, there's a few differences. In the areas, you know, in France and Switzerland where they have ski areas, there's lift access. So there is that. Every country is very different. It can be land ownership. It can be where they're even allowed to go. You know, a lot of the ski areas in France, in Chile, in Argentina, they might be owned by all different people, right? It could be farmers who own, for sure in France, in one ski area, it might be crossing over 10 different farmers' lands. So obviously to build a trail, that's a lot more complicated. So there's every destination has different issues that they're going to have to look at. But we're trying to tell, you know, to teach skills and share knowledge across the industry that they could take back and maybe take to some of those farmers. Goes, here's the economic drivers that might be useful to you, and these are ways that we can do it with the least impact on your land, so that kind of thing.
So that's the type of thing that maybe you could include in a trail building course, like talking about land rights and things like that.
Or yeah, to be honest, I don't. You know, really, with our sustainable trail building, we're working more on the actual building and designing of trails.
Yeah.
And then that's for the people in those, you know, in those destinations. They know best what their own rules are, but by sharing resources. So, with the BC Bike Symposium, they have government studies that show here's the economic impact that, this had, so that they could take that study to their own, municipal government and say, look, here's how they did it in this area. So I think it's sharing those ideas, not telling them this is how you should do it. But if they take studies and then they can take those and use them in the way that best suits their destination.
Sounds like you know how to interact with municipalities. And maybe that's something we can delve into a little bit more after our break here. Do you have a song that you want to play for our listeners?
Well, I spent several years in France and I kind of got a bit of a liking for a lot of old French music, and Edith Piaf is mm-hmm. one of my faves. And, you know, I did a lot of, I wouldn't say regretful, I did a lot of different things, traveling, and made some maybe less than conventional choices in my 20s. And so the rien de rien, you know, the mm-hmm. No regrets from Edith Piaf is okay. my song.
Well, that's coming up here after the break. Couple ads, and then we'll be back in with more background on Shelley Quinn.
Chagrin, mes plaisirs, je n'ai plus besoin de balayer les amours avec leur trémolo, balayer pour toujours, je repars à zéro. Bien qu'on m'a fait, ni le mal, tout ça m'est bien égal. Non, rien de rien, non, je ne regrette rien, car ma vie.
Love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek coffee today.
Are you a writer?
Listener?
Dreamer?
Music nerd?
Want to cover artists?
Visit venues?
Write something?
Events?
Personal essays?
Anything.
Submit to Discorder Magazine and then take it a step further on Hail Discordia with your hosts, Zoe
and Izzy. Hail Discordia is an audio translation of Discorder Magazine. We interview writers, play music and soundscapes, and do a deep dive of each zine issue. Hail Discordia plays at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on the third Thursday of every month on CITR 101.9 FM.
Submit something for the magazine and come onto the show, or just tune in and listen. We promise it's worth it.
Are you tired of Big Brother bookstores trying to sell you some billionaire's favorite book or Heather's top picks? Then you should check out Vancouver Books. Vancouver Books is a new online family-run bookstore. A portion of their profits go to First Nations reconciliation and environmental projects in British Columbia. They provide their customers with the most interesting books in fine arts, signed first editions, First Nations photography, fine ancient books, occult, and so much more.
They also provide carbon-free delivery to anywhere in the Vancouver area. So go to www.vancouverbooks.ca to check out Vancouver Books today. That's www.vancouverbooks.ca.
Looking for an audio escape to put your mind at ease? Landscapes by Dune is a musical journey through sampling and field recording. From the busy streets of Toronto to BC's picturesque landscapes, the Belgian artist recorded an array of sounds during his travels across Canada. Landscapes will be released on Pop Qatari Records Bandcamp on December 8th and will be available on all streaming platforms on December 15th. For more information, check out at Dune as Dune on Facebook, Instagram, and SoundCloud.
Welcome back to Outdoor Pursuits with yours truly, Jade Quinn McDonald. This is CITR 101.9 FM. We are resuming our chat here with Shelley Quinn, aka my mother. We have talked about what the Whistler Adventure School is, what it does, what it do be in the future, maybe. Well, maybe we'll get into that a little bit more. But now I want to get into who you are behind the shield of the general manager. Okay, so we were just getting into a relationship, you know, between municipalities and its people, municipalities and trail builders, and what that could look like for a place like Scotland or France. But, you know, how did you foster a relationship with the municipality of Whistler? Do you know from experience what it's like to interact with councillors and mayors, or is it just innate?
No, I guess I've had a little bit of experience working within, you know, I'm not involved in politics mm-hmm. so much, but I'm definitely an active community member in Whistler. And actually, just before I started working for the Adventure School, I got involved in a kind of a cool project, basically through a friend of mine that I knew. I used to work in France many years ago. We can mm-hmm. talk about that later, but who lived in a resort called Les Deux Alpes mm-hmm. in France, in the mountains, not too far from Grenoble. And they were saying how Whistler in the, you know, kind of the ski industry, and they are developing biking, and Whistler definitely has a name also in Europe, and that they would love to kind of be more affiliated with us. And that kind of started a cool project. I had time on my hands because I was taking a little bit of a break between career moves. And so together with this person who introduced me to kind of the mayor and a few key people in France, in Les Deux Alpes, we got to do a really amazing project with them. They have this big bike race called Mountain of Hell, mm-hmm. Which is a crazy bike race that they do in July. They start at the very top of their glacier, so it's a race that starts on snow. It's a mass start. It's mayhem. Pretty crazy to watch it in person. And they go careening down the glacier for the first, I don't know, maybe 750 kilometers or so. And then it goes into pretty dodgy single track and goes all the way down through lots of different trails into the valley. And then the following week in Alpe d'Huez, which is the mountain just across the valley, they do the Meg Avalanche, which is a similar. So these two bike races have become pretty famous. And so we worked with the Les Deux Alpes municipality to kind of bring some key people from Whistler, whether it be political, in the education sector, and in the government sector, over to France, to Les Deux Alpes, to experience what it would be like to be in this race and to experience, you know, life there. So the Les Deux Alpes Council were incredibly generous, and they kind of made it possible for us to bring 10 people. So we brought some WARCA, which is the Whistler mm-hmm. Off-Road Mountain Biking Association, held kind of a contest to get some top bikers that we could place in the Mountain of Hell bike race. So we brought kind of four people from Warka over. We brought a teacher from, we have a French school here in Whistler, which you might know about, Jade, mm-hmm. called La Passerelle. And we had a teacher. So we were looking at trying to kind of twin education, sport, and municipality between mm-hmm. between our two communities. And then we brought the mayor and a couple of council members, also someone who worked for Whistler Blackcomb, so, and for the Chamber of Commerce. So we really tried to bring in business, commerce, education, sport, and politics over. So it was a pretty hefty undertaking. Mm-hmm. And they were amazingly welcoming and accommodating to us. The girl rider that we brought over, Christina Cepeda, she won the female category, which was great. One of the teachers from La Passerelle the following year carried on and did an exchange with some Whistler school kids.
That's fantastic.
That went over there, which was great. The actual kind of twinning of resorts didn't quite work out, but mm-hmm. it certainly did bring a greater friendship between the resorts. And, you know, that nasty old COVID kind of mm-hmm. came not too far on the heels, and that did put a slowdown on some of the things. But, you know, I like to think that there were definitely some lasting benefits from that trip and from people, you know, going over there and seeing how things are run in a different place.
Right. So the idea of kind of a twin city or a sister city, did that come from the sister city that Whistler has right now, which is Karuizawa, Japan?
Yeah, well, I mean, twinning is a pretty well-known phenomenon. Okay. Like, it's not just Whistler and Karuizawa. There's, mm-hmm. You know, I think just about any town you see, they're going to say that, you know, they have a twin somewhere. Mm-hmm. The question is more, is there an unlimited amount of twins that mm-hmm. you're going to have, or is it a finite amount? Whistler and Karuizawa have had an amazing relationship for many years that the school kids get to benefit mm-hmm. from, which is a group of kids will get to go to Karuizawa, Japan. And why don't you tell us how that was?
Well, that was great, but I'm, you know, more curious about the industry side of things. Where are we looking for places that are just ski resorts? Are we looking for places that just have similar topography and flora and fauna? Are we looking for the culture? Because Karuizawa definitely doesn't have the same culture as we have here, but they have some points with, you know, the leaves change color over there too, believe it or not.
Yeah. You know what, I can't speak. I mean, I as I said, I'm not involved in municipal politics or any form of politics. I wasn't around when Karuizawa became a twin city. I mm-hmm. think it's to enrich, you know, and share knowledge. I think one thing that Whistler did decide when we were going through the Les des Alpes thing is that they were just going to stick with one official twin city, which makes sense because mm-hmm. twin definitely implies two, mm-hmm. But that they could have less formalized kind of sister cities or friendship mm-hmm. cities and resorts and learn from each other. So that's kind of what, at least at the moment, Whistler mm-hmm. Is doing. But, you know, I think it's great to share cultures. I don't think they have to be identical twins. Mm-hmm. You know, twins mm-hmm. can be different with some similarities.
Yeah. So I'm kind of seeing a latitude trend here. We're kind of staying similar area if we, you know, travel east or west, if we're going to Japan or France. You also kind of, I mean, obviously you went to New Zealand and Australia and lots of other places as well, but I know that you spent a lot of time in France and you spent some time in Japan doing instructing.
So I kind of, it's funny because now, you know, I'm at Whistler Adventure School, but when I followed the traditional education model after high school and I went to Western University And then I did do a year in France when I was there. Back in the early 80s, that was a bit more cutting edge than it is now. I mean, now I know exchange programs are super popular. It was a little bit less known back then, but I had an opportunity to go and study in Nice in France. And that kind of kick-started me with a love for travel. And I did finish my degree, but in the meantime, I was going to Europe every summer. I did like a swap program and worked in Ireland and my dad was a bit more traditional, like you get your degree and then you can, you know, travel. So I took him at his word. And once I had my degree, I kind of went, okay, done my degree. I'm going off traveling now. Mm-hmm. So that led me to go. First, I went to Australia, went to New Zealand and got into ski instructing. And it's kind of funny when I look back at it, because I grew up skiing in Ontario. So I hadn't lived in British Columbia yet. So the New Zealand mountains were like the biggest, you know, thing. I guess I had skied a little bit in France at that point. And then through ski instructing, there was, especially down in Queenstown, there was a large segment of the people that did double seasons. And that sounded pretty cool to me. So I did a season in New Zealand. And then I got an exchange to do instructing in Switzerland, in Crans, Montana. So I did that for a season. Then I went back to New Zealand. And then there was an opportunity to go to Japan. And I worked at Shigakogen in Japan as an instructor, and then back to New Zealand. So it was kind of a flipping back and forth, instructing for a couple of years, and then discovered this other phenomenon of British tour companies, which isn't such a big thing in Canada, but it was really big in the UK, going on holiday to Europe with a company that would arrange your accommodation and also take you skiing. And so I got in with a company called Nielsen, and that propelled me into several more years of working ski seasons. We called them ski leaders, because we couldn't be we didn't want to be confused with like a certified mountain guide, but really we worked with, we got to just take people skiing, which was super fun. So it also propelled you off the beginner slopes and doing snowplow with kids too, just showing people the mountains. And so that was pretty fun. And I got to do that in Courchevel, in La Plaine in France, in Morzine. Actually, Courchevel was the last place, and I did three seasons there. And then was going back to New Zealand in the meantime, and also working for a tour company called Ski Express.
Holy.
So I got to kind of get out of the instructing and get into just skiing with people, which kind of was more fun. It actually, I think, made me a better skier than instructing, because a lot of instructing is going slow and explaining the basics. And we just got to ski around with people. And I took up telemarking for a couple of years, and, you know, just to change it up. And I did that for, I guess like 6 or 7 years. And then decided that maybe it was time to move back to Canada. And the thought of going back to Ontario, where my parents were, was not all that appealing, because I had been living in resort towns. And there's something special and unique about living in a resort town. It attracts, whether you're in New Zealand or France or Switzerland or Canada, it attracts very like-minded people. And so Whistler was a pretty obvious choice for me. It was one of the few areas that I even knew about in Canada, because all this time I wasn't living in Canada at all. So really I'd only lived in Ontario. And so with the British tour company I was working with, I actually said, okay, I'm ready to go back to Canada now. And I came to Whistler with that company. So that's what brought me back to Canada.
Okay. And how long did you stay with that company when you were in Whistler?
Actually, I think I just did, I did 2 winters, but in the meantime, it gave me the idea, because that wasn't a really big thing for Canadians, but it was really big for British. And I had lots of experience, you know, both in the front end and doing, you know, some managerial stuff. So I started my own tour company. Mm-hmm. And golf was just starting to be a thing in Whistler. And even though it's not the same kind of adrenaline sport, mm-hmm. it's kind of funny because in the mid-90s in Whistler, mountain biking wasn't a tourist thing either. Mm-hmm. Like golf was a bigger, better bet than mountain biking, which seems crazy
yeah.
to look at it yeah. now. But, you know, Whistler Bike Park wasn't open yet. There were trails here, but it was more just for locals. Mm-hmm. So I started a golf tour company. For the first 2 years, I kept working for the British ski tour company. And then I changed my own company into a golf and ski tour company. And I did that for about 10 years. You know, when I started it, the internet was still mm-hmm. at its, you know,
at nascent its, stage.
Yeah, yeah. So even having a website was cutting edge, which mm-hmm. is so crazy when you think about it. But there was no booking.com. There was no hotels.com. Like there was nothing. So I had a business partner who was a bit more savvy in the mm-hmm. tech field than I was, because I was not savvy in that. And we had a website and we started doing tours, and it went really well. We were small, but, you know, small but mighty in the small Whistler world. Mm-hmm. And went along pretty well for a few years. And then, you know, things started to change around us, and those mm-hmm. big companies did start to develop. Mm-hmm. And eventually, about kind of 10 years later, we decided it was time to maybe get out mm-hmm. because it was getting hard to compete. Mm-hmm. So I actually sold to a larger company in the States called Golf Zoo, because I did have a pretty hefty kind of mailing list mm-hmm. and cred here in BC. Mm-hmm. And so we sold to them and worked for them for a couple of years. But, you know, when you sell your own business and then work for someone else, mm-hmm. there's always, it's not quite the same. And at that point, I decided to kind of get into a new industry and started working in the education industry.
That's great.
Yeah.
So when you made that transfer to the education industry, did you always have in mind that you wanted to work for an outdoor education type of school, or was it just...
Well, when I first started, there wasn't, like, Whistler Adventure School didn't mm-hmm. exist yet. But I worked for another company called Tamwood, who had more of an ESL school.
Right.
And I guess part of it came from my love of travel and my understanding of what it's like to arrive to a new country. You know, I liked working with the students. Mm-hmm. That was a fully international school, more just teaching language. It still obviously attracted people who wanted to come to Whistler mm-hmm. because there's lots of ESL schools in the cities. But... So it did attract mountain lovers from all over. And yeah, I just loved it because I got to be dealing with, you know, I definitely have a taste for dealing with international people. And if they were going through a bit of culture shock, you know, I went through that. You know, their first 2 or 3 weeks in any place when you're on your own are always the hardest. Mm-hmm. So I think I had a good level of empathy and understanding, and met lots of really great students through that job. And then, you know, stayed with that for several years, and then decided to have a little break, mm-hmm. did the stint with Les Deux Alpes mm-hmm. and doing that. And then this opportunity for Whistler Adventure School came up, and it just kind of ticked all the boxes.
Because, sounds like it.
Yeah, I mean, I love that what we're teaching is really all the things that Whistler is about mm-hmm. that. And I've lived here now almost, you know, I'm 27, 28 years, and I do love my town. I love the sport. I love the outdoor lifestyle. You don't have to be an extreme biker or an extreme skier. You know, you see that on YouTube, but really you just have to love getting outdoors and trying it. And mm-hmm. so I love that we teach those kinds of skills to people who want the opportunity to come here.
That sounds amazing. So for those people wanting to maybe, oh gosh, it's going to have to get cut out. thank you. So for those people wanting to get into a private education sector, like maybe the people that you guys end up hiring at Whistler Adventure School to do these courses, right, for intro students. What would you recommend? What kind of avenue would you recommend? Would you say go be a ski instructor, work internationally, or can you do it?
You mean to be a teacher?
In other ways. Well, yeah, like, you know, anywhere. Maybe you can talk about a range, like whether, you know, to be an administrator at an outdoor ed school, do you have to be like a friggin' top tier skier, or should that be reserved for, you know?
Well, no, I mean, there's totally different roles, like in any business, right? Mm-hmm. So, of course, it helps to, you know, you want to like what we're doing and love being in the outdoors and, you know, being in the outdoor industry. To be an instructor, like all of our instructors are professionals in whatever it is they teach. So, you know, in our marketing and media, our photography and videography teachers are professional photographers mm-hmm. and videographers that are focused in the adventure tourism industry. So it's going to be different than doing portraitures, you know, sitting in an mm-hmm. office. Our students get their cameras and they're going out and shooting mountain biking and, you know, so those skills can be used in any kind of business. But so to be an instructor, it's really to get experience and be all of our mountain sport. So for our adventure tourism, they're taught by certified mountain guides. And that's, as I said before, a big undertaking. Mm-hmm. It's not something you do in a 6-month course. To become a certified ACMG or Canadian mountain guide, you need to put in many years. And that's we're very fortunate. We have some of the top guides as our instructors mm-hmm. who contract to the school. Similarly, for the bike mechanic, you know, it's one of Whistler's probably top bike mechanics who went over. Our bike mechanic course is a kind of an international certification, and it stems from an organization in the UK called SciTech. And so when you get the Whistler Adventure School certification, it's also Europe certified.
That's good.
So there's very few places that do a certification for bike mechanic. Mm-hmm. And we're now doing also the level 3. So really, it's giving you skills also working with e-bikes, which is super popular now.
That's cutting edge.
Yeah. We're trying to make sure that we're keeping up with mm-hmm. the demand, because e-bikes, like it or not, I mean, I like it because I have one, that they are becoming the norm, mm-hmm. Not on all trails, but on some. And if it gets more people out on their bikes, then that's great. But we need people who know how to fix them.
Mm-hmm. Ain't that the truth? Okay, well, I think that's given our listeners a pretty good overview of who you are and what Whistler Adventure School is all about. Is there anything you want to add in closing?
Not really. It's
okay.
My biggest pleasure has been living here in Whistler and raising such a lovely daughter.
Oh, God.
Sorry, that was the embarrassing
moment.
I'm not
including that.
Aww.
Okay, well, thank you
thank
for
you.
Taking the time out of your morning.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. Bye-bye.